I can't help feeling that we've been sitting down for a while, so why don't you stand up?
Stand up! Come on.
And maybe put your arms in the air like that. Maybe not if you've got a personal freshness problem. I mean, we don't want to offend people sitting next to us. And maybe what about bend down, touching the knees, touching the toes. Maybe a bit of a dance, you know, if you can do that kind of thing. No, don't bother with that, actually, come think of it. And now sit down. Because we're going to study a blockbuster passage this evening that Sarah read to us. Can't actually see the bottom. Alright, but if you're all getting fed up, just give me a bit of this, right? And I'll totally ignore you and carry on anyway. Okay, right, so we are looking today at this amazing passage in John's Gospel, and this is actually a double header. So we've got two, next week we're looking at John chapter 3, verses 16 to 21. I'm sure most of us will know that. John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. An amazing, amazing verse to look at. Next week, we're looking at both of these under a title, Light and Life. And today, in fact, you had a, the slide that you had looked rather good. It just said, the Word lived among us, which is the title we're looking at today, as we look at these incredible verses. So, I'd like to start, however, by sharing a little insight into life in the Davis household at the moment. Because right now, whichever room I go into, there's some celebrity TV show on. It's either Strictly Come Dancing or what's that one called? Celebrity Strictly Come, I can't remember what it's called now. But mostly, I have to say, it's I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Who has heard of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here? Who has seen I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here? Oh, come on, you're not telling me the truth. You've definitely seen it. I know you're all devotees. The latter, it is on all the time. I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Honestly, it's just non-stop in our house. I'm not a fan of the show. I don't watch the show. Don't ask me for a view on whether Joel or Adam or Scarlett will win tonight and be crowned the King of the Jungle. I don't know anything about it. I can't give you a view on that. But I am fascinated why people watch this particular show. It certainly isn't Frant and Dec, that's for sure. Can't imagine anyone tuning in just to hear them. And I think the answer is because if you watch that show, you really get into a position where you know the celebrities that are on it. You know, unlike Interview with Celebrities in Hello Magazine, you know, we get this kind of airbrushed view of the celebrity. You know, here's so-and-so relaxing in his Malibu mansion, enjoying his new life with his new wife, Samantha, and their Bichon Frise dogs, all that kind of stuff. Completely airbrushed. No one can have an airbrushed existence on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. It's just not possible. They're put into extreme situations. They're under the camera 24 hours a day. They're hungry. They're dependent on other people. We get to see these people, these celebrities, as they really are. I think it's true to say. It's compelling viewing for lots of people. Obviously not me, but lots of people love I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. It has occurred to me, however, that ITV are missing a trick. Because to make it really compelling viewing, and if they want to draw a global audience, then instead of the usual kind of celebrity list of kind of B-list celebs, you know, ex-EastEnders actresses, or people who want to revive, you know, daytime telly stars, or retired footballers, or Carol Vorderman, all that kind of gang who appear on this. If they really want to kind of get the global audience, they need to get some A-list celebrities in. In fact, the best way to do it would be to allow us, the viewer, at the outset of the show, to decide which global celebrities we want to appear on the show. Don't you think? I mean, it might be difficult to get them, but I should think before you become a fully signed up member of the A-list celebrity group, your terms and conditions should allow you, should in fact require you to attend I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Just beginning to think about this, you could have maybe Elton John on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out. I mean, can you imagine him tucking into, you know, one of the bush chucker trials, eating spiders, eating fish eyes, eating all of that stuff that they have to do. Or a politician, Donald Trump. Don't you think? He would be awesome just lying there, one of those bush chucker challenges, or celebrity, you know, one of those sort of celebrity challenges, maybe as he has to kind of lie there for 10 minutes with I was seeing the other day, I just happened to be on while I was in there, but there were something like 24 albino snakes slithering over someone who was in there for like 10 minutes. I think Donald Trump would be an excellent candidate for that, don't you? Or maybe some royalty, Prince Charles. You know, surely before you come king, you should have to participate in Celebrity Cyclone or something of that sort. I think it makes a lot of sense to me. But I think people would like that because you get to see real celebrities as they really are. You know, not the view of themselves that they want to project through their image consultants, but those people as they really are, whether it's Cristiano Ronaldo or Taylor Swift, whoever it happens to be. If you could ask them to be on there, you really would see what they're really like. Now, for lots of people, God is as remote as the most elusive celebrity. He's never actually seen, and from the evidence we have about him, it's very difficult to say what he's actually like. I mean, he's issued various communications, sure, in a lengthy book, some of which seem okay to some people, some of which seem a little bit out of date. There's his creation, agreed. But that seems a bit over the top in places. I mean, why such a big universe, for example? What's that about? And, of course, God has millions of fans. Some are really great, but some seem determined to give God a bad name. It's a mixed picture. And for a lot of people, they just shrug their shoulders and say, we can't know God. He's an elusive celebrity. We just have to put up with these questions that we'll never get answers to and accept there's no way we can know about him. But the amazing truth of the passage we read today and the really sensational message of Christmas is the fact that far from being unknown and unknowable, as many people think, God really wants to be known. And he's taken an incredible step to do that. He hasn't just sent some celestial messages to us that we need to decode, you know, to work out what he's like. He hasn't just left us in this world to kind of work it out for ourselves and the world around us, a sort of Indiana Jones quest, you know, putting together clues to find out what God is like. Instead, as this passage tells us, he has sent someone. He sent us the best representative of God that there could ever be because he sent his son, his one and only son, who is in the closest, most intimate relationship with him, Jesus Christ, who is himself God, as it says in verse 18 of today's passage. God's desire to make himself known is encapsulated in the particular word used to describe Jesus in our passage. And that is this word, the word. You'll see it there in verse 14. And it's repeating the use of the word from verse 1. One of the most famous verses of the Bible. In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God. This term, the word, is a unique description applied to Jesus. And it channels themes from the Old Testament of the living and dynamic power by which God reveals himself. Right from the beginning of the Bible, you may remember in Genesis that God creates by his word. Genesis 1 verse 3, and God said, let there be light. He said it, and there was light. God's word is powerful. And now Jesus is revealed as the word. He is God's ultimate self-disclosure. He's the way God has chosen to communicate with the world that he has made, to make himself known. As it says in verse 18, the final verse of the section we were reading today, no one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in the closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. God can be known. It's a blockbusting truth. But for some people, that doesn't go far enough, because if God can be known, what is he like? Well, the answer to that is contained, here we are reading the prologue, the first 18 verses of John's Gospel. And the answer to that is contained throughout the whole of John's Gospel. What is God like? Shown to us in Jesus Christ. But in this short section we get to read today, we can learn, I think, four things about what God is really like that are contained in this section. And so I'm going to use the rest of our time together to draw those out for us. And the first is in the first three are actually from verses 14 and verse 14. And the first thing I think that we can learn from this is the lengths that God will go to in order to reach out to us. The Word became flesh. When John uses the word flesh, he's deliberately emphasizing the very physical transition that Jesus made into human form, literally into skin and bone, a real man. It wasn't a case of Jesus just temporarily taking control of a human being. It wasn't the case of Jesus just posing as a human being for a while. He became a real man, irrevocably becoming a real man. It's a startling fact. And Jesus took this extreme step so that we really can know God in the way that you can only know someone of your own kind. I mean, think about it. If Jesus had become as a kind of superhero or an extraterrestrial, then we as human beings wouldn't have been able to know him fully. It would no doubt have been a lot more convenient, probably more straightforward, probably more comfortable for Jesus to come and visit us in that way. But it would have been inconsistent with God wanting to become fully known. I think it's truly astonishing when you consider what this meant for God. The Bible elsewhere picks up on his humility in taking this extraordinary step in coming as a human being. In Philippians 2, it says, being in very nature God, Jesus did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. You see, I think we don't see the full magnitude of this step because, you know, for us, we're used to being humans. You know, it has its ups and downs, but we're sort of okay with it. It's not that bad. But from God's perspective, it's somewhat different. I've used this illustration before, but imagine, if you will, becoming a dog. Being a dog is fine if you're a dog. But if you were to transform yourself into becoming a dog, imagine the frustration that you would experience from the limitations of your life. Why, you wouldn't be able to go out for a walk without going through the pantomime of getting the lead, looking with pleading eyes at your owner, whining plaintively until you've been taken out. And imagine your helplessness if your owner started feeding you with something you didn't prefer, maybe replacing your chosen tin of Pedigree Chum with some inferior own brand substitute. What could you do about that? Well, the answer is absolutely nothing. You weren't meant to be a dog, and so to become a dog would involve daily and constant and enduring frustration. Now, it's a trivial illustration, but, you know, in Jesus' case, in order to be known by us, he was willing to subject himself to a lowering far, far greater than just a human being becoming a dog. You know, we can scarcely imagine what frustrations and challenges it involved. But he was willing to do it because, in his love, he wanted to reach out to us and become known to us. So I think that's the first thing we can learn about God. The lengths that he will go to make himself known. The second thing we can learn is of his desire for a real relationship with us. In verse 14 it says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. John very specifically says that. The literal meaning of the word, he made his dwelling among us, is that he pitched his tent. To allow himself to become known, he literally moved in with us, the human race. If you've ever shared a flat with someone, you'll know that it cannot be beaten as a way to get to know someone else. Sometimes, unfortunately, you get to know them rather too well. How long it takes them to respond to their alarm in the morning, for example. Or how many cosmetic products they feel compelled to use and cram into a very small bathroom. Or, in one case with a previous flatmate I had, their use of the airing cupboard to brew various strange alcoholic concoctions. Or the fermented tofu recipes that they insisted on cooking with spicy noodles, days on end. We get to know people incredibly well by living with them. It's really the best way to get to know someone. In Jesus' case, he lived for 3 years with John, the author of John's Gospel, and with the other disciples. Not as flatmates, but as a teacher and disciples, trampling the dusty roads of first century Palestine. With no fixed place to stay, You can imagine that Jesus would become almost transparently known by the other disciples and by John. You've got to think that is an amazing step for Jesus to take. The Word who was with God from the beginning was willing to expose himself to that level of kind of transparent scrutiny by the people that he lived with. And as an aside, it's amazing that there's never a single mention in any part of the New Testament of any shortcoming or flaw in Jesus' character. You'd absolutely think that living in those conditions would throw out some weakness, you know, some irritability or shortness of temper, some act of self-centeredness, some other personal flaw. Yet none of the New Testament writers say anything of that sort. In fact, Peter goes positively in the other direction and says in 1 Peter 2:22, he committed no sin. He committed no sin and no deceit was found in his mouth. And as we read at the end of this verse 14 of John 1, John describes Jesus as being full of grace and truth, you know, having lived in very close proximity with him day after day. But it wasn't just so we could study Jesus or marvel at his moral perfection that the Word made his dwelling among us. It was for a bigger and more amazing reason still. And it was because God wants to have the closest kind of relationship with people. A friendship. We see this from the very beginning of the Bible. The story of the Garden of Eden is one of a close, even intimate relationship between Adam and Eve and God. There's a delightful picture in Genesis 3 when God is heard walking in the garden in the cool of the day and calls out to Adam and to Eve, "Where are you?" Presumably, he wants the man and woman to come and join him on his evening walk. We can only imagine, but you'd think he wants them to enjoy his company, to inform him of the events of the day, to hear his thoughts and get his advice, to enjoy his conversation and relish his company. It's difficult to get a grip on this, but think of an occasion when you've been so uplifted by the company of someone special. You've so blossomed in their presence that you're almost walking on cloud nine when you're with them. Time and surroundings seem completely irrelevant. You don't care about anything but the conversation you're having with them. This will be a pale glimpse of what it must have been like for Adam and Eve, enjoying friendship with the creator of the universe. But of course, those of us who know the story know very well, they don't get to enjoy that moment, because at that very time, Adam and Eve have just fallen for the serpent's lies and have disobeyed God by eating the fruit of the one tree of the garden that they were told they couldn't eat from. With the consequence that instead of enjoying the evening walk with their loving creator God, they're banished from the garden. They're forced to live with the consequences of their rebellious action and the introduction of what the Bible calls sin. The biggest catastrophe ever to befall the human race and the root of all of our problems. Instead of finishing with his creation, from that point on, the Bible is all about God looking to reconnect with people, to be with us on the kind of level that Adam and Eve enjoyed in the Garden of Eden. We hear about him living amongst his people in the tabernacle, and the same with the temple that's built under Solomon. But nothing approaches the intimacy of his relationship with Adam and Eve until now, when Jesus, himself the very nature God, takes the step of coming to live as a man, to live cheek by jowl with people in first century Palestine, in order that people can know and have a relationship with him. So that's the second amazing thing we learn about God. He wants to have a real relationship with people, his people, and he's willing to go to incredible lengths to achieve that. Third thing, I think, that we learn about God from this passage. And that is we see his unmistakable glory. You see there in verse 14, the second sentence. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. The word glory here refers to Old Testament passages which narrate the manifestation of the presence and glory of God. This wasn't done for God's vanity. It was done to give his people confidence and certainty that he was truly great and that he would be with them, his power protecting them and his wisdom guiding them. For example, I mentioned God dwelling with his people by means of the tabernacle. And in the second half of the book of Exodus, God's people are building this tabernacle. It's a kind of portable temple where God met with his people while they were on the move. And there were exacting requirements they had to follow. When it was finished, we read this at the end of Exodus. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. It goes on, in all the travels of the Israelites, wherever the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle, they would set out. But if the cloud did not lift, they did not set out until the day it did lift. So the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, in the sight of all the Israelites during all of their travels. It's a sign. God's glory is a sign to give confidence to his people. Similar language appears in 1 Kings when Solomon completes the temple. You can imagine the reassurance that God's people drew from having this unmistakable sign of God in their midst. And so when God the Son comes to earth to dwell amongst his people, it's the same glory that is manifest, as John tells us. He says, I saw it, we saw it, we have seen his glory. Now probably John is referring to the kind of visible manifestation of Jesus' divine nature in the Transfiguration, which the other Gospels tell us he personally witnessed along with Peter and James. It's an extraordinary incident that reassures his disciples of his unique identity. But actually in John's Gospel, which doesn't include the story of the Transfiguration, the word glory specifically refers to the signs or miracles that show Jesus' identity and his mission, culminating in the greatest, the sign of all, his death and resurrection. And so, for example, if we flipped into the next chapter and had a look at the changing of the water into wine, we'd read at the end of that story these words. What Jesus did here in Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and the disciples believed in him. And the same after the raising of Lazarus, for example, in chapter 11. It refers to this act as being a manifestation of the glory of God. These signs unmistakably identify Jesus as being God to those that saw and understood them. You cannot fake God's glory. It was quite unmistakable. But that's not an end in itself. Can you imagine the confidence and the reassurance that Jesus' disciples would have drawn from being in the presence of this incredible man? That is what God is like. He is truly glorious, and he wants us to see his glory, not for his own vanity, but for our reassurance. Another final thing I think we can draw out from this passage that tells us about God, this God that we can know in the person of Jesus Christ. And that is in verses 15 and 16, his careful long-term planning in order to make this a reality. It says here, John testified concerning him. He cried out, saying, this is the one I spoke about when I said, he who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. The John we're talking about here isn't the writer of the gospel, but John the Baptist. John the Baptist was the last and greatest of the Old Testament prophets, looking forward to the day when God's Messiah would come to redeem his people. And his testimony is therefore very significant. And what John says here is that although Jesus came after him, and so should be his junior in a world that accorded honour based on age and precedence, he is actually his superior because Jesus has always existed. In other words, he's recognising that Jesus is the Word who was with God in the beginning, in the language of verse 1. And therefore, in the person of Jesus, that God has finally come to his people. John's testimony as the greatest of the prophets reminds us that God's plan to become known to the world through sending his son as Messiah was not a last-minute plan B, but the culmination of a long-term plan to rescue mankind. A plan attested to by prophets for centuries before Christ. I think immediately after this we're going to either sing or listen to someone singing the words of O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, one of the great Advent hymns. And you might notice that each of the verses of O Come, Emmanuel starts with a title that is ascribed to the Messiah in the Old Testament, as the prophets were looking forward to his appearance. Mostly from Isaiah, prophesying in the 8th century before Christ, calling him Emmanuel from Isaiah 7, calling him the Rod of Jesse from Isaiah 11, calling him the Dayspring from Isaiah 60, and Malachi 4 verse 2, calling him the Key of David. All of these are titles of Jesus, which Jesus fulfills, revealing the fulfillment of God's incredible plan. But we read something even more incredible than that, which is that as well as being part of God's plan as outlined by the prophets, God's planning goes back further still, and we see here the role of Moses. Verse 16, out of his fullness we have all received grace in place of the grace already given. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. John is explaining here that the grace received from Jesus is a replacement for the grace already given through Moses centuries before the prophets. Out of his fullness we have all received grace in place of the grace already given, he says. And he goes on to explain what he means by that. He says, for the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. In other words, he's referring to the Mosaic law as the original gracious gift of God. But that as a means of salvation, it had been superseded by Jesus' amazing bestowal of grace. Let me try and explain that. In the Old Testament, following the Exodus, God showed his favor on his people, the Israelites, by giving them the law through Moses. We find this hard to follow because we think of law as restrictive and limiting freedom. Only lawyers like me actually like law, right? We don't normally think of it as being a gift. But actually, in the Old Testament, it was a generous provision from God because it showed his people exactly the way to win God's favor and live in a permanent and close relationship with him. The trouble was, as we all know, they couldn't actually live that way. Keeping God's commandments blamelessly, the way they were meant to be kept, proved to be way beyond God's people. All of them fell short, because all of them were, in fact, by nature, rebels against God and subject to the fallen, sinful nature that came to the world through the story of Adam and Eve, as we were talking about a few minutes ago. The law itself was good, but it wasn't able to help them because they couldn't keep it. And it's the same for us. We can't keep God's laws, even if we want to. But, says John, this isn't the end of the story, because grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Grace, meaning God's unmerited favour, and truth, meaning his covenant faithfulness, have been made available to us, not as a free gesture, but through Jesus Christ. I think what he's saying here is that Jesus, unlike any other man or woman that's ever lived, did keep God's law, as given through Moses. He always lived God's way, even in the most testing conditions. In that sense, he fulfilled the law, truly living the life that it was intended to create. And by doing so, he has allowed us to be favored by God and restored into a close relationship with him, even though we've done nothing to deserve it. Now, quite how that was possible and how we can participate in the benefit that Christ brings, we'll learn about next week when we look at John 3:16. But for now, let's just finish by marveling the amazing planning of God in bringing to fulfillment his long-term plan of salvation, culminating in him sending his one and only Son to live his way and reconnect us to God. So in conclusion, we really can know God through his one and only Son, the Word, Jesus Christ, and he really is worth knowing for the lengths he will go to reach us by becoming flesh and bones. For his desire to have a real relationship with us, by dwelling among us, by moving in. For his unmistakable glory to reassure us that he is who he says he is, and he can be relied upon. And for his amazing long-term plan, worked out over the centuries since the creation of the world and fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Let's end with a prayer. Thank you, Heavenly Father, that you did not leave us ignorant in your world, but that in and through your one and only Son, you have become known. We ask that you would help us to see afresh this Christmas what an amazing truth that is, and to get to know you more and more with each passing day of this Advent and Christmas season. Amen.